There are days for cake, days for ice cream and cookies, but every now and then, especially after a big, satisfying meal, you might be inclined to just say no to dessert. Well, after this latest installment of our Found Recipes series, you might want to rethink that.
Hi, I'm Katie Workman. I'm the author of the Mom 100 Cookbook and the creator of the Mom100.com blog. And I'm here to tell you about the most amazing pie I think I've ever had. I went down to North Carolina, and I made a beeline for Crook's Corner, which is a fabulous destination restaurant. It's been there for a very long time. It's a shrimp and grits and fried oysters and hush puppies kind of southern food restaurant. And the longtime chef, Bill Smith, was sending us out so much food, and we were having this amazing dinner, eating more than I think I've ever eaten in my entire life. I had no intention of eating dessert, and then he sent out this pie. It is a creamy citrus filling, much like the filling of a key lime pie or a lemon meringue pie, covered with billows of whipped cream, but the crust is made out of saltines. So it's this dense, crispy, thick, saltine, salty crust, which is such an amazing balance to this tanginess and the sweetness of the inside. When I first took a bite of this pie, I think the only reaction I had was, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. For quite a while, that was pretty much the only thing I could say. Definitely was a slightly Harry met Sally moment. I think I was under control, but I was in sort of a fugue state, so I can't be sure.
Well, first of all, it's not really my pie. It's a pie that's served all over the coast of eastern North Carolina. My name is Bill Smith, and I am the chef at Crook's Corner Restaurant in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I called it Atlantic Beach Pie, but down there it's just called Lemon Pie. When we were growing up, everybody believed that, for some reason, that if you ate any kind of dessert after having seafood, that you would drop dead sick. I asked my mother about that. I said, why do we think that? And she said, I still think that, and she still won't do it. But anyway, the one exception was this lemon pie that all the fish restaurants along the coast serve. The best thing about this dessert is it takes like 4 seconds to make. You cook the crust for like 15 minutes, and then the filling, another 15 minutes. You don't have to wait for the crust to cool. The only thing that takes any time is it has to cool enough when you're done so you can cut it without making a mess. But it couldn't be faster.
Oh yes, I have that recipe, and the pie was so ridiculously easy to make, but I'll tell you, there was a slightly sad grand finale to this pie, which was we ate a chunk of it, and I covered it gently with saran wrap, and we took it in the car someplace. And my husband left the car, jumped back, and jumped into a different seat in the car, and sat on the pie. And I said, did you just sit on my pie? And he said, I think I did. How do you not know if you sat on a pie? And I was so sad. Not sad enough to not eat it, but sad nonetheless. It was squished, but it was so good still.
Katie Workman talking about her favorite found recipe, Bill Smith's Atlantic Beach Pie. And yes, you also heard Bill in there. You can get the recipe and see a picture of Katie's pie before it was sat upon on our found recipe page at npr.org.
Our program is directed by Monica Evstatieva, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. We had engineering support from Andy Huther and Peter Alina.
Our planning editors are Jerry Holmes and Julia Buckley. The staff includes Graham Smith, Franklin Cater, Andrea Hsu, Gabe O'Connor, Carol Klinger, Justine Kennan, Janae West, and Rhonda Ray.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The vice president of NPR News is Margaret Lowe Smith. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
A Okay, how about something delicious? Technical advances in the past decade have allowed Vermont maple syrup producers to triple the number of taps they're putting in maple trees. This means more syrup. It also means more money. Last year, maple syrup produced $40 million in revenues in Vermont. That's double the amount from 6 years ago. Melody Baudette of Vermont Public Radio reports on the sweet taste of success.
When most people imagine maple syrup production, they think of buckets hanging from trees collecting sap. But these days, most of that sap is collected by pipeline and vacuum pumps. At this sugar house in Fletcher, Vermont, sap arrives in tanks on the back of huge trucks where it's pumped underground into tubs. J.R. Sloan's sugar house is a model of efficiency. Years ago, producers had to boil all of the water out of sap to concentrate the syrup. Now, sap is sent through reverse osmosis machines, which filter most of the water out before boiling begins. The result is pure Vermont maple syrup.
See what he's pulling out there right there? That's fancy. So that's our best product you can make. That's the highest money.
Sloan started out tapping 14,000 trees in the spring, even as he worked a full-time job. He was taking a chance when he built his sugar house.
That costed $117,000 to build that with all the equipment in it. The first year, I grossed $239,000. Syrup went wicked high that year. Got into it at just the right time.
And it's been up ever since. Now he buys sap from up to 95,000 trees, and he's left his old job behind. Sloan works on his sugaring business year-round, including tapping trees and running pipelines for other landowners. He hopes to make 32,000 gallons of syrup this year. Like most of the syrup made in Vermont, it will be sold in bulk. Sloan isn't alone in making maple his primary source of income. Vermont now has 3,000 commercial maple producers, up a third in just a decade. Even some dairy farmers who once sugared on the side have decided to sell the cows and focus on maple, like Cecile Brannon at Brannon Family Maple Orchards. When Brannon and her husband first started sugaring, they used horses and buckets.
We miss our horses and stuff, and that whole feeling of horses and the tradition. But to make it, to watch your labor and your time and efficiency, you've got to go with tubing with a mainline system.
Now the Brannons and two sons tap 66,000 trees. She says they've bought over $100,000 worth of high-tech equipment to handle that volume of sap.
There's people that are getting into it feeling that this is a get-rich type of thing. It's not. The investments that you have to make are unbelievable.
And the sugar house has not only gotten bigger, it's been redone to meet food safety standards. They've switched to new taps that prevent the holes in trees from healing up, extending the season. Vacuum pumps also allow sap to flow, even as the spring weather that sugar makers depend on becomes less predictable. Weather and climate change will always be a concern, but even last year, when Vermont had 80-degree days in March, producers made more syrup than most previous years. For NPR News, I'm Melody Baudette in Colchester, Vermont.
It's delicious, it's nutritious, and it's basically rotten. Fermentation is the hot new culinary trend, but the preservation process has its roots in ancient history. Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf explains.
People you know may intentionally be growing bacteria in their homes, on food, outside the refrigerator. And they are doing it to make food safe and nutritious. They are doing what cooks have always done, fermenting food. For decades, we have fought against bacteria in our food, and now we're being told to make love, not war, on germs. Before you wrinkle your nose, consider this. If you have ever eaten bread, cheese, chocolate, or yogurt, or drunk beer, wine, or coffee, you have had fermented food. There are bad bacteria, but many are beneficial. Okay, non-scientists, stick with me. Fermentation is the process where bacteria and yeasts feed on the sugars in food. That creates lactic acid, a preservative. It is what Washington College anthropology professor and fermenter Bill Schindler calls controlled rotting. The results are the probiotic foods you hear about: miso, tempeh, the fermented tea called kombucha. The nutrients are intact, the foods are easier to digest, and new flavors have been created. Katie Chang, an award-winning kimchi maker, says fermentation is magic. You make nutrients and flavors that didn't exist before, using what's in the air around you. This taste of time and place gives your food what some fermenters call microbial terroir. Yeah, like in wine. Chefs, artisan food producers, and just plain folk have been touched by fermentation magic. New York super chef David Chang is working with a Harvard microbiologist to try new things at his Momofuku fermentation lab. Recently, pistachio miso cashew tamari. Sandor Katz is considered the guru of fermenting food. He calls himself a fermentation revivalist, trying to bring back an ancient tradition. In his introduction to Katz's book, The Art of Fermentation, food writer Michael Pollan says we've been living in an age of Purell. He calls fermentation, quote, an eloquent protest against the homogenization of flavors and food, now rolling like a great, undifferentiated lawn across the globe. Katz says he wants to demystify fermentation so people won't be afraid. Then, maybe we can all feel the magic.
Bonnie Wolf is managing editor of American Food Roots. This is NPR News.
All right, if you happen to be listening to this program while having a mango for breakfast, there is a good chance that mango was grown in Mexico. Our neighbor to the south says it is now the world's largest exporter of fresh mangoes. India still reigns as the king in exports of mango products. But as NPR's Kerry Khan reports, Mexican mangoes are now being grown at an astonishing rate, and the American market is the main target.
Mexico's mango production has skyrocketed. Last year, nearly 300,000 tons were exported, mostly to the United States. Mexico City fruit vendor Alfonso Maximo says demand is high.
No hay cosa más rica que el mango, ¿no?
He says nothing's better than a mango. Maximo flawlessly slices a ripe, yellow, fleshy Ataulfo variety into a plastic cup for a waiting customer.
Estamos partiendo un limón para que...
He adds a squeeze of lemon, then chili powder on top. Mango lover Jaime Klen says all other fruits pale in comparison.
Por su sabor, su textura, me gusta mucho.
He says it has the best flavor, the best texture. He loves them. He sure does. He bought 9 pounds. Americans are eating plenty of mangoes, too. U.S. consumption jumped more than 30% in the last 5 years. Megan McKenna of the National Mango Board says that's because mangoes are trendy, used in all types of cuisines.
In sweet, savory recipes, and included throughout the day, from breakfast all the way through, you know, a little sweet snack before you go to bed at night.
The spike in mango exports is mostly due to proximity to the U.S., Mexico's largest market. With shorter transportation times over those coming from Asia, Mexican growers can leave the fruit on the tree longer, says Jorge Armando Celis, president of Mexico's mango exporters.
Como que tienen más contenido de azúcares.
The more time on the tree, says Celis, the sweeter the fruit. Kerry Khan, NPR News, Mexico City.